This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear about business and property tax breaks, Portillo's and Brandt may leap to mind, but it's not just new or expanding businesses looking to take a bite out of their tax bill.
Whenever those assessed values decline or dip, that affects our revenue. And that means teachers in the classrooms, that means higher class sizes.
Kurt Richardson from Unit 5 Schools talks with GLT's Ryan Denham about settling a years-long dispute with thousands of dollars in precious tax money at stake. Laura Kennedy talks with GLT's culture maven and the interim dean of Milner Library about sexual harassment in the entertainment industry. And hear about the first hand-painted, handwritten Bible created in more than 500 years. Judy Valente has that story. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's November 30th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. This month, Brandt Industries became the latest company to seek tax breaks from Bloomington Normal School Districts and other local taxing bodies. They want the tax breaks to bring new manufacturing jobs to town. But it's not just new and expanding businesses like Brandt that are looking to cut their property tax bill. GLT's Ryan Denham reports on why some of the county's largest taxpayers are pushing back.
Hundreds of McLean County property owners this fall challenged the assessed value of their properties, which determines their tax bill. This year, that included dozens of student apartments, hotels, banks, and shopping centers, some of the county's largest property taxpayers. They want to shave tens of thousands of dollars off their tax bill, money that school districts and other taxing bodies depend on. To avoid unpredictable revenue losses, Unit 5 this fall negotiated a compromise agreement with First Sight and other apartment owners who were looking to cut their bills on 26 different apartments. It locks in the assessed value of those properties through 2022. A second agreement is in the works with Young America Realty, which has challenged the values of at least 15 properties this year. Kurt Richardson is Unit 5's attorney. The district gets 60% of its revenue from property taxes.
Whenever those assessed values decline or dip, that affects our revenue. And that means teachers in the classrooms. That means higher class sizes. It's important to protect that local property tax base.
The First Sight and Young America agreements are not the first of their kind, and they won't be the last. State Farm Insurance reached a similar agreement with taxing bodies for its properties in 2010. The former Mitsubishi manufacturing plant and the Clinton Power Station have been involved in their own tax disputes. In light of the recent tax breaks approved for Brandt's new manufacturing plant, agreements like these raise an interesting question for other McLean County taxpayers. Which property owners are big and important enough to get to negotiate an agreement with local taxing bodies in the first place? This year, the owners of 883 properties in McLean County appealed their assessed valuation, which is supposed to be one-third of a property's market value that's used to calculate your tax bill. It's actually fewer appeals than in recent years. There were 1,600 of them in 2009, the height of the Great Recession. Most appeals come from homeowners who think their assessed value, determined by their assessor, is too high. The higher the assessed value, the higher the tax bill. But for homes, the dollar amounts are so low that taxing bodies don't typically raise a stink when the cases go before the county's three-member board of review. But for larger commercial properties seeking a reduction of $100,000 or more in assessed value, those taxing bodies are asked if they want to intervene in the appeal. With more money at stake, they often do. That's what happened for the past 3 years between Unit 5 and First Sight. Normal Township Assessor Rob Cranston says it began in 2015 when his office noticed that more and more of the college student apartments were being under-assessed.
We looked at the apartments and saw that the luxury, all-inclusive student apartments were the most consistent and most consistently low. So those are the ones that we revalued for 2015. There were 57 parcels that were revalued for 2015.
And the apartments, assessor, and local taxing bodies have been debating their value ever since. Here's Supervisor of Assessments for McLean County, Robert Common, who oversees the Board of Review.
Certainly, you can see around the university, ISU, all of the new housing going up, and this is across the country. The scale of that housing is quite upscale. So the assessor and the property owners don't necessarily agree on what the value is of those upscale properties. So we're seeing a lot of contentious appeals regarding what's it worth.
The stakes are high for Unit 5, which is one of many local taxing bodies strained by flattening revenues and inconsistent funding from the state. One example, First Sight's 1010 Lofts on Main student apartments in Normal, the former site of a movie theater, which has an assessed value now of $3.4 million. That means it pays $289,000 in property taxes annually to nine taxing bodies, most of it $169,000 for Unit 5 schools. This fall, First Sight asked for the property's assessed value to be reduced to $2.4 million, which would cut its overall tax bill by $85,000, including $50,000 lost by Unit 5. That's just one property. Unit 5's First Sight agreement covers 26. That agreement, by the way, set the 1010 Lofts assessed value at $2.7 million, a compromise between both sides. Richardson, the Unit 5 lawyer, says that because Unit 5 hires outside counsel to help with these appeals, these agreements are a good option because they can help the district avoid years of legal costs. He says each property can be appealed every year, and cases can take more than 1 year to resolve, trapping the district in a state of perpetual litigation with some taxpayers. And he says if Unit 5 did lose a big appeal, the district might have to refund the taxes.
So you're talking about not only updating your appraisals every year or obtaining appraisals in the first place, but then also the cost of your legal representation and legal fees. We would rather spend that tax money on our students and in the classroom as a school district. So that's one of the costs to it.
He says knowing the tax bill won't change year to year also provides stability for Unit 5's budgeting process and for the apartment owners who need to set rents. The First Sight agreement resolves appeals retroactively, dating back to 2015, setting values through 2022. And because the agreement will raise the values of some of the properties, Richardson says Unit 5 will actually see $15,000 in additional revenue each year of the deal. First Sight owner Jeff Tinnervin did not respond to requests for comment. Unit 5 school board approved the agreement October 25th. A spokesperson says the Normal Town Council will vote on it December 4th. Heartland Community College has already approved. Unit 5 expects to reach an agreement with Young America soon. Messages left with Young America owner Ralph Endress were not returned. His attorney declined comment. Cranston, the assessor, is not involved in those agreements. He says all three parties have different priorities. The assessor wants to determine what a property would actually sell for. The taxing body is generally focused on the tax revenue, and the taxpayer is focused on their tax bill. Here's Cranston on those agreements.
I do understand the taxing body's perspective and the taxpayer's perspective on these settlements. They just do not mesh real well with the objectives of my office.
The local property tax appeal process has even become an issue in the Democratic race for governor. Candidate Chris Kennedy criticized the process as overly political in comments earlier this year, a subtle shot at House Speaker Mike Madigan, whose law firm does property tax work. Here's Kennedy on GLT during a summer visit to Normal.
Now we know with great certainty that the system is a fraud, that it's corrupt, that the outcome of your assessment has less to do with the construction of your home than your access to a great lawyer or whether or not you've made financial contributions to the assessor, his campaign or hers, or their political party.
Back in Bloomington Normal, Eastland Mall could be next in line for a similar agreement. The mall is the county's third largest taxpayer, sending $1.4 million annually to local taxing bodies, including $871,000 to District 87 schools. Records show that the mall's owner, CBL Properties, appealed its $16.9 million assessed value this fall, but has since withdrawn it. The struggling mall is working on an ambitious redevelopment plan, with new tenants already announced, though many stores remain vacant. CBL cited those store closures and retail bankruptcies in its original appeal. CBL attorney James Regan says he withdrew the mall's appeal because, quote, we have determined that the issues involved in the status of the mall require an extensive review. We wish to withdraw the 2017 appeal with the understanding we'll be able to arrive at a resolution on the mall's assessed valuation that serves the interest of McLean County and CBL. District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley says it's possible that Eastland Mall's assessed value could decline in future years, given its struggles.
The good news is they understand that that is a big deal, and they've withdrawn that, but I could see that coming back In the future.
Eastland Mall spokesperson Melissa Cavanaugh declined comment. Riley says those agreements can present a dilemma for taxing bodies. He doesn't like to do them because it tends to limit the amount that District 87 would expect to get, but it's sometimes beneficial because it helps keep it from going down much worse should an appeal process go through and no compromise is reached.
So those things can happen, and they're more unique and rare and will engage in conversation because, you know, those companies, especially companies out there, I think they understand the importance of public education, services to the community, and they're not real interested in hurting those. At the same time, they tend to be businesses. They're impacted by their bottom lines, and they're trying to look out for that as well. So they kind of have to weigh that also. And we have to be good stewards to our taxpayers and not always look to get everything that we possibly can without doing our part to help grow our own local economy. And sometimes those decisions are hard, and you don't have a crystal ball and know what it's going to look like 5 or 10 years down the road. But you go in with some understanding and a level of experience to help predict that, yeah, if we allow this, we're going to see some benefits in the long run that everyone in the community will benefit from, including us, the taxing body.
The annual Board of Review appeals process is now wrapping up. Taxpayers can appeal Board of Review decisions to the state's Property Tax Appeal Board, or PTAB. I'm Ryan Denham.
See an interactive graphic showing McLean County's top 25 largest taxpayers, including many student apartment owners, at our website, WGLT.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, proud to serve you from his new office in historic downtown Bloomington. Justin offers life insurance options to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Hear about the first illuminated Bible created in 500 years and find out how you can see fine art reproductions of some sections in Bloomington Normal. Judy Valente reports ahead during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Kevin Spacey, Harvey Weinstein, and now Matt Lauer and Garrison Keillor. The entertainment industry is currently embroiled in ongoing sex scandals that have the news media, Twitter, and morbid curiosities churning. Nearly 100 years ago, the film industry endured a series of equally shocking scandals that eventually resulted in a code of conduct for on-screen and off. But would the solutions then help Hollywood now? Laura Kennedy has more with GLT's Culture Maven.
There's plenty of talk right now of scandal in Hollywood, with the famous and the powerful being exposed as sexual predators. But years ago, before movies could even talk, there were other scandals that drew the white-hot glare of public scrutiny and forced the film industry to make some changes to ensure its own survival. In 1921, popular comedian Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle was accused of rape and manslaughter in the death of starlet Virginia Rappe. In 1922, renowned director William Desmond Taylor was murdered. The killer was never found. And in 1923, matinee idol Wallace Reid died while in a sanitarium trying to kick his addiction to morphine. These three scandals and more sparked condemnation from religious, civic, and political groups who demanded the film industry clean up its act. Sherry Zeck is the interim dean of Illinois State University's Milner Library and GLT's culture maven. She says this type of notoriety was not what Hollywood studios wanted, so they instituted a kind of self-censorship known as the Hays Code.
Hollywood had an interest in shaping up, but there were other things going on too. There was the Ladies' Temperance League and other movements to clean up the movies themselves. So these real-life scandals added fuel to the fire that was already making smoke See, I'm trying to stick with my metaphor here, was already making smoke to change the content of the films. And really, the Hays Code was much more a preemptive strike against impending government censorship, really. The scandals of the 20s and other issues helped the studios tamp down on their talent, over whom they had, by the 1930s anyway, pretty close to absolute control anyway, in terms of their careers. And so there was much more concerted effort to protect and cultivate certain images for the stars by the 1930s. The scandals of the 20s were one part of that, but it was also just plain business that stars and their lives were of interest to the public. And so the best way to keep the public coming back was to keep those stars and their public lives a curated spectacle and not real life, as it were.
So that was Hollywood back then. Hollywood mm-hmm. was the studio system back then. We had these handful of studios that had strict control over their actors, over their employees,
right.
and hopefully, they thought, over the message. Now, Hollywood's a whole different landscape. It's a more of a wide-open town.
Mm-hmm.
And you get somebody like Harvey Weinstein, who went rogue with his behavior for years upon years upon years. And we have Weinstein and other people like Brett Ratner. We're hearing all these terrible stories about these Hollywood players. Is this a blip in history, or is this another chance where Hollywood's going to look at itself and say, you know what? Maybe we need to change things.
Well, first of all, Hollywood isn't a thing the way it was 50, 60 years ago. 50, my God, it's not 50 anymore. 70 years ago. Hollywood isn't a thing. It's not a unified entity. There's not the same kind of control. Weinstein, remember, he was the outsider, right? He was the leader of the independents
yeah.
25, 30 years ago. And now he's one of the most powerful leaders of one of the most powerful organizations, or was anyway. Now that he's been deposed, that's not so true. But the old joke about the casting couch, that came from somewhere. That didn't just appear in the last 2 weeks. That didn't just appear even in the last 20 years. That's been a stereotype for a very long time, and that comes from somewhere. So I think what's coming to light is our practices that are pervasive in the industry. Now, is it a blip or not? It's not a blip in terms of behavior. It might be a blip in terms of exposing the people at the most powerful levels for their behavior and there being consequences for it. That's what remains to be seen, is how deeply lived these consequences are. Roman Polanski, 20 years ago, was it?
It was the late 70s.
That long ago.
Yeah.
I am old. Time is collapsing on me. Roman Polanski, accused of rape and exiled from this country.
Because she was a minor.
Exactly.
But he won an Oscar. He went on to win an Oscar. And everybody seemed to be okay with that.
Yep. Woody Allen?
Yeah, Woody Allen.
Okay, there's a whole other one. So what we're seeing right now in terms of these consequences, that's what's a little unusual. And that's what I'm not sure what the longevity of that will be. So that Weinstein fell from power so quickly, as soon as some of these things started coming to light in the mainstream media, is what's astonishing.
Well,
not
why do
the
you think
that, itself?
Why do you
frankly.
Think that happened? Were there people who were just chomping at the bit to see that guy dethroned?
Oh yeah, I'm sure there were. But what was the tipping point? Look, something's going on in
yes.
our country, which those of us who are feminists hope sticks. But the response to Trump's election, in which how many hundreds of thousands of women marched on Washington during inauguration week, how many newspapers and left-wing causes have seen their donations skyrocket since Trump's election, I think it feels to many people like there's a groundswell of activity, of anger, of, yes, empowerment, or on the other side of, I can't believe this guy got elected. Now we have to resist at all levels because this thing happened. I think that it's that wave that is making women feel like they can speak out. That and certain levels of economic security, some of these people who have been able to speak out have achieved in their lives. That helps. I think this is a new wave of women being vocal about not liking what's being done to them. Again, whether it lasts or not, who knows? And where it has effect and where it doesn't have effect, who knows? I kind of wonder, as quickly as the news cycle changes, if Weinstein had come after Moore, would his fall have been so dramatic? I'm not sure, because the American public's interest lags so quickly.
Do you feel that the current culture of the sort of the boys' club and the guys thinking they can treat women any way they want to in the entertainment industry, is that kind of culture just too ingrained to be changed? Can it be controlled at all?
I think as more women have positions of power, not just as actors who have a following and who headed up a huge bazillion-dollar enterprise like Wonder Woman, but also as producers and writers and leaders of various related industries get into place, I think that makes it easier to make men feel less free to do whatever they want. But man, this is still a patriarchal culture, and it has been millennia in the making, and it hasn't really changed yet. So I think right now, there are probably a lot of people who are feeling worried and self-conscious about their past behaviors and their current behaviors. But I don't expect that to stick. The long arc of history may bend toward justice, but it's a long arc of history.
Well, you have the actress Gal Gadot, who, mm-hmm. of course, was in Wonder Woman. The sequel is in the works, and she's put her foot down. She says she won't do it if Brett Ratner is involved in the production in any way, shape, or form. So she's got power. Mm-hmm. She brought millions to Warner Brothers. So here we have a woman with power, and she's wielding her power in a way that's positive for all women. Now we have a good example of the use of power in Hollywood.
Yes, and she's even gone a step further. I believe she said she won't do the project if he profits from it in any way. So it's not just that he can't be on the set or he can't be named as producer. At least she's saying right now that she won't do it if he's connected in any way that puts more money in his pocket. Now, whether her various contractual obligations will really allow her to do that, I don't know. Also, it's not just that, I mean, she's Wonder Woman. She is Wonder Woman. It is good for the franchise for her to make this stance. It's not just good for women. It's not just good for Gal Gadot, and I'm really glad that she's doing this. But for this particular franchise, it's only going to make business better. I think she is operating honestly, but I think in terms of the cultural capital she has, she's not really risking a lot. I mean, one of the things that I've said at other times when we've talked is little girls are watching. Little boys are watching, young children are watching, and the more they can see people that they admire, that they look up to, whether it is a character or an actual person who is standing up and saying, that's enough, the better that is for our future, absolutely. There is already a developing blacklist. Kevin Spacey just got removed from a film. House of Cards is on hiatus or canceled, I can't remember which, although it was probably only had a year left anyway.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Tambor just left his show.
Just left his show, but word is that his character was kind of being faded out anyway. So will Jeffrey Tambor get another job? Who knows? But I imagine there will be blacklists and gray lists for a while for particularly prominent people who've been accused of things. But I expect there to be a cover-up of equal and perhaps greater intensity for other people who we don't know about yet who have exhibited or are exhibiting bad behavior. This may be a watershed moment, but right now it feels like the current news cycle.
So there's a lot of outrage out there. Do you think perhaps then the outrage is just going to peter away, that the outrage won't lead to meaningful change and reform?
There's been outrage before. There was outrage during a certain presidential campaign with a certain presidential candidate boasting about what many construed as abusive behavior toward women. A certain presidential candidate who said horrific things on Howard Stern and everywhere else, even about his own daughter, who is our president. So outrage only goes so far, and outrage is only one part of our responses to whomever it is or whatever industry it is or whatever situation in which it occurs. And already we are hearing perhaps not quite with equal force in the mainstream media, but certainly if you go into that evil world of Twitter, there is many horrible things being said about the accusers as about the people being accused. So the world's not changing this week. The entertainment industry is always malleable. What's not malleable is the underlying profit motive, okay? That's not going away. But I believe it can absorb just about anything to its own profit-driven benefit. So for every Harvey Weinstein who gets the boot, there's somebody else for whom the industry will cover up, or someone else will now have an opportunity to run the Weinstein company, or this will make some really big hit movie someday. So there's a way that Hollywood sort of broadly written can absorb quite a lot and turn it around, maybe not immediately, but eventually turn it around to just another story, just another hunk of interest. Any press is good press, right? So how many people are out there now trying to check out which films they've liked really were Harvey's pictures? How many of them are out there watching Kevin Spacey's movies and looking for hints of things? But the point is, there is great elasticity within the entertainment industry to absorb criticism, and it's much less likely, perhaps because it's not, doesn't have the same kind of homogeneity that it did in the 1930s, it's much less likely to react as a whole to a few incidents the way it did in 1934.
That's Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Illinois State University's Milner Library and GLT's culture maven. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Changes are afoot at the embattled Weinstein Company. The woman who led the U.S. Small Business Administration under President Obama has submitted a bid to acquire the film studio. Maria Contreras-Sweet leads a group of investors with female leaders from private equity, venture capital, and Hollywood. And one aspect of the bid is getting a great deal of attention. It proposes to install a majority female board of directors with Contreras-Sweet as the chairman. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I'm Mike McCurdy. Monday was an important date on the way to the 2018 elections. It was the beginning of the period when Illinois candidates have to file petitions with, in some cases, thousands of signatures needed to get on the ballot. The filing period lasts a week, but for hundreds of candidates, it was worth it to be in line first thing Monday morning. IPR's Brian Mackey was there at the State Board of Elections and has this report.
The first thing you need to know for this story is that a few years ago, the Illinois State Board of Elections moved into a strip mall. The second thing you need to know is that a lot of candidates really want to be there right when the offices open on the first day of the filing period. I'll come back to why. For now, know that most get there early in the morning. You can tell when people arrived by where they had to stand.
There's an old Radio Shack, a Tuesday morning, Chuck E. Cheese. Whereabouts did you get in line?
Just past the Tuesday morning sign, so maybe about 100 yards back.
Jeff McKay is a Republican. He's running for judge in DuPage County. A little farther down the line is Anne Marie Miles.
We got on to Chuck E. Cheese.
Miles is running for state representative from the south side of Chicago. She's not the first person to get philosophical about standing in line with candidates for governor and judge and Congress and the General Assembly.
We think of, you know, the political process as a big machine, and yet you don't think about the people who are standing out carrying their little pieces of paper that they have gone out and knocked on people's doors, stood on street corners and said, I want to make my case to the public, please sign my petition.
And that may be the most important function of the filing period. It's a moment when candidates have to put up or shut up. You can no longer just say you're running for office. You actually have to prove you've done the work to get on the ballot. Back at the mall, the back of the line is just a little ways down. You know you're at the end because there's a state trooper acting as a kind of human bookmark for the people who were in front of him when the office opened at 8.
They have the opportunity to get first place on the ballot when they run.
Ken Menzel is the top lawyer with the State Board of Elections.
There's a statistically speaking a little bit of a boost in down ticket offices with a lot of people running. First place or last place will tend to get a few more votes just from the first or last place position.
Some studies have shown a gain of a few percentage points, which could easily be enough to swing a close election. But again, the research shows this applies to down ticket races, county board or judge, not the top offices. When it comes to elected jobs in Illinois, it's hard to get more down ticket than a political party's state central committeeman, or in this case, committee woman. Rena Bever is from Mount Carmel. It's now about 10:30. She got in line at, well, let's say it was closer to the Burlington Coat Factory.
Yes, it was down that far this morning. So we are just now, we were here before 8. We're just now getting in the building.
Next to Bever is Tanya Loker from Wayne City. You wouldn't know this from the way they're getting on, but it turns out that Loker and Bever are running against each other for the same seat.
We just met each other.
And you're near the end of the line together.
Yes, yes, yes.
How's that been?
It's been great.
It has. It really has.
And you know what? If I'm not the lucky one, I hope she is, because
and
she's
I'm
great.
And I'm the same. Absolutely.
Together, Loker and Bever represent one of the less discussed benefits of this ritual of Illinois democracy, a new friendship forged in a shared experience. Not bad for a Monday morning at a strip mall outside a Chuck E. Cheese. I'm Brian Mackey.
The primary election is March 20th of next year. It's Sound Ideas. The St. John's Bible is the first hand-painted, handwritten Bible created in more than 500 years. It was a major undertaking sponsored by St. John's University in Minnesota to celebrate the millennium. The Bible contains elaborate calligraphy as well as illuminations or artwork using precious metals. The original Bible never leaves the library at St. John's, but fine art copies of the individual books in it do. Starting in January, the New Testament and Acts of the Apostles will be on display at the Ames Library of Illinois Wesleyan University. Judy Valente has more on this extraordinary project in this exclusive GLT interview with Jim Triggs, one of the St. John's Bible's curators.
St. John's University is a school run by Benedictine monks. In the Middle Ages, monks were civilization's scribes, copying and creating Bibles and other significant documents. In celebration of that Benedictine tradition, St. John's engaged Donald Jackson, an Englishman who is the official calligrapher to the British crown. Jackson wanted to create an illuminated Bible for today. Jim Triggs, who is a curator of the St. John's Bible, says that resulted in some surprisingly contemporary images brought to life by ancient artistic techniques.
One of the things that we try to do when we show illuminations, we don't share the illumination and describe it. What we try to do is get people to talk about it, that this Bible is very communal. That is, unlike a cell phone or a smartphone where it's just you and this phone and it's very singular, what happens with this Bible is you open the pages, and much like we had in the lobby just now here at the radio station, all of a sudden four or five people came around and they said, look at this and look at that. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the most important aspects of this project, the fact that it really invites people to participate and enjoy.
What kind of spiritual experience has it been for people who see it?
For people that are familiar with the Bible, It's interesting because they typically have their favorite verse or their favorite part of the Bible, and they want to go to it, see how it's treated. I've heard numerous occasions where a relative of someone who invited somebody to come see the Bible, and of course the relative came reluctantly, and they were really mesmerized, and there was sort of this sense of awe when they saw it. But when they see it and they hear the story of the St. John's Bible, they come to me and say, thank you so much for inviting me. This has really been inspiring. There's certain things that you can enjoy on the internet. This is one of the things that you really have to see live and in living color to really appreciate it. And so we're really thrilled that Illinois Wesleyan is going to have it on campus to share.
You're not going to see a lot of medieval symbolism or imagery in this. There's really a lot of modern contemporary references in these illuminations.
Yeah, absolutely. A really good example of that is in the Luke parables. There's a series of parables in Luke that are celebrated. The parable of the lost coin, the lost sheep, the Good Samaritan. And while Donald Jackson was working on the parable of the prodigal son was when the Twin Towers were hit. So that very day. And so Donald memorialized that by actually including the Twin Towers in the genealogy of Jesus at the beginning of Matthew as a way to celebrate the humanity of Jesus. You'll see the double helix DNA molecule. So that makes a theological statement that we believe Jesus was truly human, but it also is a timestamp of sorts. So someone 1,000 years from now will say, oh, this must have been done after the 1950s because that's when the DNA molecule was discovered. You'll also see images of microscopic images of the AIDS virus and the leprosy virus, and yet on the other side of the scale, you'll see images of deep space taken by the Hubble telescope. So it was really meant to sort of capture the world today and celebrate knowledge and understanding that we know today in a way that would resonate. But then you'll also see icons, beautiful Eastern icons by Aidan Hart, which is very traditional, especially in a number of the illuminations in Gospels and Acts.
Why did St. John's University in Minnesota want to do this project in an age where you have graphic design, you can do all kinds of things on a computer? They hire artists to hand paint and do hand calligraphy of the whole Bible.
Donald Jackson, at a very young age, had this dream of handwriting the Bible. In fact, he told Barbara Walters that on the Today Show back in 1979 that was his dream. And he was always looking for someone to partner with. And we got to know him because we would host calligraphy conferences up at St. John's. And in 1995, he basically pitched the idea, what if you, St. John's, a Benedictine institution with the rich heritage of illuminated manuscripts from the past, hire me to handwrite a Bible using the same tools as medieval days, but capture the art and capture the essence of Christianity at the beginning of the 21st century and make it a gift to the world in celebration of the millennium.
You mentioned Benedictine there, and we should explain that the Benedictines are the founders of Western monasticism, and they were the scribes.
Absolutely, and there's some beautiful manuscripts. If you think of the Book of Kells and many other great manuscripts of the past, it was more often than not, it was Benedictines that were doing that, and they were really capturing history. So we look at the St. John's Bible not just as a celebration of a beautiful book arts that took place many, many years ago. But if you think about how much we learn from past civilizations through the books that we have now, the St. John's Bible is meant to be a gift for future generations as well. So imagine someone looking at this Bible in the year 3017, 3018, and they see Hubble-esque images in our illuminations, and they'll look back and say, oh, that's such a 21st century take on life on Earth.
Well, you're using the term illumination, and maybe we should explain what that is in terms of this Bible project.
So an illumination is really nothing more than a beautiful picture or illustration that has metallic material that reflects light. And whether it be gold or silver or platinum, in the St. John's Bible, those illuminated pieces, those pieces that reflect light, actually represent the presence of the divine, the presence of God. And so they're sort of used strategically and artistically in each of the illuminations.
And there's actual gold leaf in it, as I understand.
Gold leaf and silver leaf and platinum. As a matter of fact, the materials that we use in the St. John's Bible are identical to what you'll find in the Book of Kells and other illuminated manuscripts. And the idea of using those materials is not so much to recreate history, but rather, if you look at the Book of Kells, it's in phenomenal shape. So we have the same sort of vision for this, using these organic materials like calfskin vellum and gold leaf and these organic minerals that are used for the paints and so forth. You know, we have this vision of it still being in great shape in 1,000, 2,000, maybe 3,000 years.
What exactly will people see at Illinois Wesleyan? What has Illinois Wesleyan gotten from St. John's University?
So unfortunately, the original manuscripts we have to curate. So we have to worry about temperature and humidity control, and we can't let people touch it, and it's very valuable, and we have to watch how much light is exposed. One of the reasons why we actually created what we call the Heritage Edition. So if we go back to the mission of the project, the mission of the project is to ignite the spiritual imagination of people around the world of all faith journeys. So how does a small university in the middle of Minnesota from Lake Wobegon reach the world? And the main way we're doing it is through the Heritage Edition. So we created something that is as close to the original as possible. And one way we did that was we had Donald Jackson be the artistic director of these volumes. So these are limited edition volumes, and they're true to the artistic intent of the original, and we're making these available to universities. So we have something called The Year with the St. John's Bible, and that's exactly what Illinois Wesleyan is taking advantage of. So we're going to actually have a volume on campus for a full year.
Now, people are not going to see the whole Bible. Let's not get people too excited out there. They will be seeing a part of this Bible. What part of the Heritage Edition will they see?
These volumes are so large. They're about 1.5 by 2 feet in dimension, and we can't bind all the entire Bible from Genesis through Revelation together. And so we've divided the Bible into 7 volumes. And the one volume that will be here has the 4 Gospels and the Apostles.
The work that went into this. I mean, this was a humongous effort that involved numerous artists. But just talk about the specifics of how they went about this job.
It was daunting, and much more daunting than anybody thought. I think they knew it was going to be daunting going in, but it's one of these things that was even more daunting. So Donald Jackson, again, it was his idea, but he's an artist. He's not a theologian. So one of the first things he said to St. John's is, okay, you're going to have to give me a little bit of direction. I need some scholarship behind this. And so what St. John's did was they put together something called the Committee for Illumination and Text. And this was a combination of biblical scholars and theologians and artists and art historians. And their job was, we want this to be a Bible for the 21st century. We want something that resonates with the world today. So themes like care for the poor, care for the sick, the dignity of all people, the embracing of science and discovery, the glorifying God's words. These are some of the major themes that we wanted to capture in the art. And so that the scholars would write briefs for certain verses and areas of the Bible, and then Donald would take these verses, and then he would assign certain artists that he knew to do the illuminations. So there was a team of the 6 artists that did the bulk of the work, and there was also 6 calligraphers. And the 6 calligraphers, unlike the artists who brought their own traditions to bear, the 6 calligraphers were all trying to do their calligraphy in the same style.
Same style, right. And I think you mentioned to me at one point that it took 12 hours to do just one page of this hand-painted calligraphy?
Yes, it would take 8 to 12 hours to do one page. They would sort of manage this by having the same calligrapher work on facing pages so that your eye can't pick up the difference. And then they would typically do the calligraphy first and leave space for the art. Most of the calligraphers were in and around Wales, but the art came from artists from around the world. So unlike monastic times back in the medieval days, these pages were flying all around the world. They would leave space for the art, maybe roll up the piece of vellum, and they would ship it to a studio in California. Thomas Ingemeyer is one of the artists who worked on this in California. Suzanne Moore at the time was in Ohio, so she would have pages sent to her. So that's one of the big differences between medieval times and today. We were sort of leveraging the fact that we have artists from around the world that participated in this.
So you have these pieces of this artwork flying around the world. How did St. John's University, as you say, a liberal arts school in Wobegon country, pay for all this?
Yeah, that was another big one, because like every other college, we've got all sorts of pressures. We want to make sure we have scholarships available and building funds and faculty needs to be paid and so forth. So Brother Dietrich Reinhardt, who was the president at the time, and his team, Rob Culligan, who was in charge of institutional advancement development, they did a very good job of reaching out to sort of non-traditional sources. So one of the companies, which is surprising, that put a fair amount into this early on was Target Corporation. So Target put about $3.5 million into this project, and they really viewed it as a beautiful work of art. And there was a series of exhibitions that they helped sponsor, and there was also quite a few non-traditional donors to St. John's who came forward that heretofore had not been that actually knowledgeable who St. John's was, but they fell in love with the St. John's Bible. But there's also lots of individuals. We took donations of $5, and there was a Boy Scout troops and Girl Scout troops that donated to this. So I'm not sure if this number is correct, but something in the order of like 1,500 different donors made this possible.
And the overall cost was, in the end?
Yeah, we don't disclose that. We think as much as the Boy Scout and Girl Scout troop that donated, as much as the $1 million donations. So it's something that the university doesn't disclose, but it was definitely in the millions.
Has this project revived an interest in calligraphy and the almost lost art of illumination at one point.
Well, I tell you, it's one of the people that I think has done a lot of revitalization of calligraphy is Steve Jobs, and the impact it's had on Adobe PostScript and the kind of fonts that we now use in everyday life. I had an experience at a college where one of the calligraphers, Diane Von Arx, was actually doing calligraphy out in the hallway prior to her talk. You would be amazed to see the students who were gathering around, and what she would do as a courtesy would she would do their name in beautiful calligraphy. And again, this is a calligraphy is a form of art. It's very, very beautiful, and just that sheer beauty of it draws people in. And so, yes, we've seen a lot. And also, in every city, it seems like there are calligraphy guilds that come out of the woodwork to see this Bible. They either know Donald Jackson, or they've read his books, or they've taken classes from Donald Jackson. And so, yeah, we think it's having a big impact.
Illinois Wesleyan's Evelyn Chapel was able to obtain the reproduction of the New Testament on loan through a $9,500 grant from the Merwin Multi-Faith Fund. Wesleyan will kick off its year-long celebration of the Bible with a free lecture by Tim Turns of St. John's University on January 18th at 6:30 p.m. in IWU's Westbrook Auditorium. GLT's Judy Valente spoke with Jim Triggs, one of the St. John's Bible curators, here on Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. There can be more than Santa Claus coming down the chimney during the holiday season. A local author has compiled a collection of spooky stories of the season for her new book that wishes a Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good fright. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook.
It's the most wonderful time of the year to get scared out of your socks. And one way to do that is to check out the latest book from Central Illinois author Sylvia Schultz. The Spirits of Christmas, The Dark Side of the Holidays, reveals strange and scary tales for a long winter's night. Schultz says she had a blast researching and uncovering the various tales in the book, many of which harken back to the Victorian era and beyond.
And I pitched it to my publisher once I had gotten a dozen stories or so and realized there was something there. And he said, oh, that's right, you could do this and this and this. Hey, wait a minute, why am I not doing this book? Just kidding. I think you should do it. I think you'll do a great job at it. So I ended up with over 120 stories in it.
Wow. So, Sylvia, why are ghost stories, particularly at Christmas time, so popular? Can we blame that on Dickens and A Christmas Carol or what?
We certainly can. The popularity of Dickens' The Christmas Carol is just a faint shadow of how insanely popular these stories were for the Victorians. Even before the Victorian age, Christmas was seen as the spookiest time of the year. Forget Halloween. I mean, it's Christmas. You've got long, dark nights. You've got little daylight, and they're the longest nights of the year. And everybody knows, in the dark, that's when the monsters come out. But it was the Victorians who took this and really ran with it. And Dickens is just one example. The Christmas story anthologies that the Victorians put together, they read like an AP English reading list. I mean, you've got Dickens, you've got M.R. James, you've got Arthur Conan Doyle. Doyle actually introduced the character of Sherlock Holmes in one of these Christmas stories for these anthologies that came out.
So, Sylvia, tell me about a story that you uncovered that really surprised you, that you didn't know was out there.
One of my all-time favorites is the ghost story of the naked chicken.
I'm sorry, the naked chicken?
The naked chicken.
Okay, all right. What?
This absolutely delighted me. In December of 1943, there was an airman home in London on his leave, and he was crossing Pond Square in London, and he heard carriage wheels on cobblestones. And he thought to himself, well, that's kind of weird. And then he heard something that was even more incongruous for a square in London in 1943. He heard the indignant squawking of a chicken. And he looked to where the sound was coming from, and he saw an absolutely plucked, naked chicken running around And it ran around in circles for a few moments and then vanished through a wall. This chicken has been appearing in this pond square in London for centuries. The way it started was in April of 1626, Sir Francis Bacon was taking a carriage ride with a friend of his. Bacon looked out of the carriage and he noticed that the wheels of the carriage were picking up clumps of snow, and underneath the clumps of snow, the grass was still green. And he thought, hey, wow, you know, let's see if we can utilize this for food preservation. I bet if we froze something really quickly, then it would keep longer. And his friend's like, oh, no, I call shenanigans on this. That's never going to work. But Sir Francis Bacon was so intent on proving this theory that he had just come up with that he had the carriage stopped, ran to the nearest house, and said, do you keep chickens? And the woman said yes. So he bought a chicken, killed it, plucked it, eviscerated it, and stuffed it full of snow. And a few days later, he brushed the snow off of it, and it was perfectly fine to eat. And he said, hey, this is wonderful. Unfortunately, Sir Francis Bacon did not get to enjoy this discovery that he had made. He shared it with the world, but he didn't get to enjoy it for very long, because as he hopped out of the carriage and ran through the snow looking for a chicken to pluck, he contracted pneumonia, and he died April 9th, just a few days after he discovered this wonderful thing.
So maybe the chicken got its revenge after all.
Exactly. The chicken has had its revenge for all these 300 years.
That's Sylvia Schultz, author of The Spirits of Christmas, The Dark Side of the Holidays. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can find Schultz's new book on Whitechapel Press. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal and WGLT.org. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from Laura Kennedy, Judy Valente, and Ryan Denham. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post your comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.